welcome to the Halloween edition of the Book Report. I've got a show full of tricks and treats. Classics by horror's headliners and new scary tales so frighteningly fabulous, I just had to share them. So, gather your kids, light the jack-o'-lantern, and grab one of those bags of candy. And we'll take a ghoulish glance at page one of the Book Report. Come to Miami for the warm winter weather and for the 29th Miami Book Fair International, where Tom Wolfe, Juno Diaz, Lemony Snicket, Sandra Cisneros, and more than 300 authors from around the world will read from their books, answer questions, and autograph their books. All at the nation's largest book fair, 29th Miami Book Fair International, November 11 through 18. Information at miamibookfair.com. In Ray Bradbury's unforgettable gothic masterpiece, Something Wicked This Way Comes, something evil arrives in a small Midwestern town on the crest of the autumn wind. A dark carnival with frightening attractions and supernatural characters sets up stakes. It's up to two 13-year-old boys, James Nightshade and William Holloway, to save the souls of their town. The book is narrated by Paul Hecht.
"Howdy, boys," called the man all dressed in storm-colored clothes. "Folks home?" The boys shook their heads. "Got any money yourselves?" The boys shook their heads. "Well..." The salesman walked about 3 feet, stopped and hunched his shoulders. Suddenly he seemed aware of house windows or the cold sky staring at his neck. He turned slowly, sniffing the air. Wind rattled the empty trees. Sunlight, breaking through a small rift in the clouds, minted a last few oak leaves all gold. But the sun vanished, the coins were spent, the air blew gray. The salesman shook himself from the spell. The salesman edged slowly up the lawn. "Boy," he said, "what's your name?" And the first boy, with hair as blonde white as milk thistle, shut up one eye, tilted his head, and looked at the salesman with a single eye, as open, bright, and clear as a drop of summer rain. "Will," he said. "William Holloway." The storm gentleman turned. "And you?" The second boy didn't move, but lay stomach down on the autumn grass, debating as if he might make up a name. His hair was wild, thick, and the glossy color of wax chestnuts. His eyes, fixed to some distant point within himself, were mint, rock-crystal green. At last he put a blade of dry grass in his casual mouth. "Jim Nightshade," he said. The storm salesman nodded, as if he had known it all along. "Nightshade, that's quite a name." "And only fitting," said Will Holloway. "I was born 1 minute before midnight, October 30th. Jim was born 1 minute after midnight, which makes it October 31st. "Halloween," said Jim. By their voices, the boys had told the tale all their lives, proud of their mothers living house next to house, running for the hospital together, bringing sons into the world seconds apart, one light, one dark. There was a history of mutual celebration behind them. Each year, Will lit the candles on a single cake at 1 minute to midnight, Jim at 1 minute after, where the last day of the month begun, blew them out. So much, Will said, excitedly, so much Jim agreed to, silently. So much the salesman, running before the storm, but poised here uncertainly, heard, looking from face to face. "Holloway? Nightshade. No money, you say?" The man, grieved by his own conscientiousness, rummaged in his leathery bag and seized forth an iron contraption. "Take this, free. Why? One of those houses will be struck by lightning. Without this rod, bang, fire and ash, roast pork and cinders. Grab." The salesman released the rod. Jim didn't move, but Will caught the iron and gasped. "Boy, it's heavy and funny-looking. Never seen a lightning rod like this. Look, Jim!" And Jim, at last, stretched like a cat and turned his head. His green eyes got big and then very narrow. The metal thing was hammered and shaped, half-crescent, half-cross. Around the rim of the main rod, little curlicues and doohinges had been soldered on later. The entire surface of the rod was finely scratched and etched with strange languages, names that could tie the tongue or break the jaw.
We've just heard "Something Wicked This Way Comes" by Ray Bradbury. Erwin Yablans is Hollywood's godfather of horror. He was the executive producer and driving force behind iconic horror classics, including Halloween, Halloween 2, Hell Night, and Scream for Help. His successes have made Michael Myers' Halloween masks standard inventory in costume shops, and Michael's name part of the American lexicon. His new book, The Man Who Created Halloween, is wonderfully readable. Let's meet him now. Welcome, Erwin. Thanks for visiting us on the Halloween edition of the Book Report.
My pleasure, Elaine.
Now, you were born in Brooklyn. I was born in Pittsburgh. Yet, we share a common memory from our childhood. Your mother and my grandmother washed the floors every week and covered them in newspaper. You gotta wonder why. Why was that?
You're not that old. You can't be that old.
My grandmother was.
Oh, my goodness. Old habits die hard. Did she have linoleum?
I think so.
Oh, my God. We had that, as I describe in the book.
Yes.
This florid, ugly linoleum. But I'll tell you, it shined all the time.
What brought you from the East Coast? You were born in Brooklyn, as I said, to the West Coast.
I grew up in Brooklyn, as I said in the book, and my brother and I both. And we were Depression-era kids, and life was tough. We were poor. We left school at an early age when we both went into the Army, and when we got out, we were looking for something to do. We had our futures were not too promising. So somehow we wound up, because we had met some man at a beach resort in Far Rockaway. It actually was a bunch of little bungalows. And he said, "When you get out of the Army, look us up. We can maybe give you a place in the shipping room." So we wound up loading trucks for Warner Brothers. And because in those days, if you didn't need the college credentials and the educational tools that you must have today, but if you had energy and you had desire, you got noticed. So we eventually got up to the sales office, and we wound up going through the distribution system. In those days, all the movie companies had offices all over the United States. Usually there were about 35, and I was willing to take $5. I would load up my car and go any place for a raise. And so as a result of that, I kind of accelerated my career, and it was distribution. It was sales of movies. In those days, you actually got in your car and drove around, say, in Michigan, and drove all over the state and called on little theater owners, and many of them sort of did it as a second avocation. Many of them had hardware stores and other businesses, and you have to catch them on the fly. And I have an episode in the book that I describe where I found some guy painting his fence, but you'd sell the movies right out of your car. And it was a great training, great education. You got to meet people all over the country and got to understand the regional differences. And eventually I found myself in Los Angeles at the Los Angeles office selling movies. I was a salesman. Once I got exposed to the movie business and the people actually made movies, I began to realize this is what I really wanted to do. By that time, I had progressed to the point where I was sales manager, and I was moving up in the ranks, and my brother was charting a parallel course. My brother wound up as president of Paramount Pictures. I'm just cutting through the fat, but that sort of curtailed my activities at Paramount, and I decided it was time I went out and made my own movies and started my own company. I created a company called Compass International Pictures with a young lawyer by the name of Joseph Wolf, who helped me raise $50,000, and we decided we would distribute movies. Well, the problem with that became the reality that that we had no movies to distribute and they were hard to come by. So it was necessary for us to make movies. Well, I started to look around and figure out how we could do it, and we didn't have the funds. But along the way, I met a man named Mustafa Akkad. Mustafa Akkad was a man who had made a movie called, very appropriately to be discussed today, a picture called Muhammad, Messenger of God, that nobody wanted to distribute in the United States. And so it was a story of the prophet, and it starred Anthony Quinn, Irene Pappas. It was quite an epic, but no one wanted to do it. And Rogers and Cowan, the famous public relations people, they called me and asked me if I would take a look at the film and meet with him. And I did. I thought the picture was beautiful, and I told him that I would love to do the film, but I don't have the resources. He agreed. We made a deal to provide the funds for Prince advertising and all the marketing expenses.
This is Elaine Charles of The Book Report, and we'll be right back. Come to Miami for the warm winter weather and for the 29th Miami Book Fair International, where Tom Wolfe, Juno Diaz, Lemony Snicket, Sandra Cisneros, and more than 300 authors from around the world will read from their books, answer questions, and autograph their books. All at the nation's largest book fair, 29th Miami Book Fair International, November 11 through 18. Information at miamibookfair.com. We're back with Erwin Yablans, Hollywood's godfather of horror and executive producer of Halloween.
I had met a young man named John Carpenter who had made a picture called Assault on Precinct 13 that I distributed. It didn't do a lot of business, but it was something that showed me a young man with great talent. So I was in London on my way to Milan for a film festival when I got a phone call from a certain Michael Myers. And he was an Englishman who distributed movies in England, in London, and asked if he could meet with me. I said, yes, of course. And he said, I love this movie. He said, I think if we enter it into the London Film Festival, it can really get a lot of attention. And I said, wow, that's exciting. And so we made a deal. He did that. It won the London Film Festival. And that got me thinking about how I had to find a film for this young talent. I was on my way back from Italy, and I was thinking to myself, I've got to find a movie for this guy. I got to find something that we can do together because he's a rare talent, and eventually the studios are going to find out about him, and I better get to him before they do. And well, it has to be a horror film because my theory about horror films and being universal and their appeal. And I said, wow, maybe we'll do a movie about babysitters in Jeopardy, because that's something that everyone can relate to. Babysitters, or everyone's hired a babysitter or been a babysitter or been a baby. So I kept thinking, yeah, we'll do it all in one night because we can control the costs and locations will be limited. And Halloween popped into my mind out of nowhere. And I said, wow, Halloween. I wonder if anyone has ever done a movie with called Halloween before. And yeah, I'm going to call John Carpenter right now. And I got on the phone. I had to throw my bags down. I said, John, I got him. I said, John, what do you think about a movie about babysitters in Jeopardy? And it all takes place on the scariest night of the year, Halloween. He said, oh, my goodness, don't tell me anymore. I got the whole picture. Boop, boop, boop. We bounced ideas off one another, and I gave him some simple guidelines. I said, look, I said, John, this movie has to be theater of the mind. Think of a radio show. What the audience sees is what they conjure up in their mind. And I want this orchestrated so that the spooks and the scares come methodically every so often, and the audience gets jangled and totally throw them off balance. Let's take them to the right side of the screen and scare them on the left. He understood that completely. And I said, no blood or gore. This has to be character-driven. And I said, can we do it for $300,000?
Actually, what was the biggest hurdle you had to overcome with such a small budget?
Well, just about everything. The first thing you have to overcome is getting the picture finished on time and on budget. The second is to get the quality that will allow you to get into theaters and not have it look like a a student film. I had to get the money. I didn't have $300,000. I go back to my partner Mustafa Akkad. Later on, we increased the budget by $25,000 to get Donald Pleasance. Well, John called me up one day and told me he wanted me to meet Jamie Lee Curtis, a young actress that he thought would be right for the part. So I met with her, and she really was impressive, and I knew she was a real fine little actress. But what really intrigued me more than that was the fact that she was the daughter of Tony Curtis and Janet Lee. More Janet Lee than Tony Curtis, because in my mind I got this whole image of Psycho. And if I could get a photograph of her mother in the shower scene.
I want to ask you, with technology so far advanced right now, what kind of advice would you give to filmmakers who are trying to get their foot in the door?
Just go make a movie. It's easier than ever. With digital cameras today and all the lightweight equipment, anybody with a good idea or a good story, go out and make the movie. For example, the key to Halloween, I think, is the story. The story is a good one in that you care about these people. There's an element of truth to it. And I believe that for young filmmakers, my best advice would be write or get connected with a good writer. The book is more than just the story of Halloween, although that is the hook, as they say. You know, the subtext is how a bit of desperation and inspiration created the movie that changed the way Hollywood movies were made. And I talk a lot in the book about how I came from relative obscurity, from a childhood that was deprived, from a future with no promise, and how I was able through, not overnight, but through a long process of work and application and perseverance, achieve something.
I want to tell the readers that your book is really readable. Every page, you just connect with you as a person, like, instantly from page one. And I want to congratulate you on that.
Oh, you're so kind, Elaine. It's nice to talk to somebody whose business is books for a change. By the way, that movie's coming out. You know, we're releasing that film in 1,000 theaters this Halloween for the first time since the initial release.
Oh, I don't know if I've got the guts enough to watch it.
Thank you so much, Elaine. I appreciate your time.
Okay. Bye-bye. In Moscow, the sound of bones echoes across Red Square. In America, skeletons patrol the streets of Manhattan, and blood stains the cornfields of the Midwest. In Washington, Abraham Lincoln heads for his third term in the White House. The best and worst of humanity are back with a vengeance in Skeletons by Al Sarantonio. His dark tale follows a skeletal army hell-bent on conquering the living and uniting the world under the banner of the dead. Against this bloody backdrop of global horror, a small group of refugees find themselves drawn together by a single vision and a shared fate to determine whether the last two humans on Earth will survive or join the ranks of the newly risen. Peter Jude Riccardi narrates.
Today, something happened to me. Mrs. Garr, my counselor at Withers, has said that I'm like a seed, closed tight and ready to grow. She says that I am mute because my voice, too, is locked inside the seed. She says she is a gardener, and that she is trying to find the right kind of soil, the right sun, and right water to make me sprout. Today, for the first time, I felt the seed shiver. This early summer day at Withers Home for Women in Cold Spring Harbor, New York, started like any other day. All of us up at 6:30, the donning of drab uniforms, washing and brushing, a half hour of calisthenics in the gym with Mr. Carey. Then breakfast in the prison-like cafeteria. Rows and ranks of benches and tables, no talking permitted. The stacking of trays, back to our rooms. An hour of meditation, they call it. Aloneness, I call it. Then therapy, followed by lunch, again eaten in silence. Then the television room. The tyrant, Margaret Gray, the oldest tenant of Withers Home for Women, was waiting there, because that is when we are finally left alone. As always, she waited until Priscilla Ralston, her 18-year-old toady, put on the television to the religious channel, waited until Priscilla had regained her chair. Then she quickly moved to the front of the room, climbed a chair, and turned to face us. "We'll learn," she said, her thin hand closing into a bony fist, her eyes darting the room, daring anyone to contradict. Even her voice was hard and mean and thin. "We'll watch and we'll learn." She climbed down, stood under the television like a sentinel, making sure all eyes stayed on the set. Everyone remembers Laura Payne, the girl whose eyes were scratched out. Laura was big, nearly 20, knew how to laugh. She came to Withers last summer, nearly a year ago, and was blinded a month later. She had an alcohol problem and beautiful blue eyes. For 3 weeks, she put up with Margaret Gray's television tyranny, then got up one day, pushed Margaret aside, and put the soap operas back on. The other girls cheered. Laura smiled, stood sentinel where Margaret had been until Margaret left the room. We watched the soap operas the whole week. Then, on Friday morning, Laura didn't appear for breakfast. They found her in her room, fists pressed tight to her scratched-out eyes, drunk. The staff said she had smuggled the liquor in and done it to herself. Priscilla Ralston told one of the other girls that Margaret Gray had held a knife to Laura's eyes, which Laura thought were her best feature, and made her drink until she passed out. According to Priscilla, Margaret had said, "If thine eye offend thee, pluck it out," and then slashed Laura's eyes while she lay unconscious. When television time ended at 4, we went back to our rooms for more enforced loneliness. At 5, I saw Mrs. Garr for an hour. Mrs. Garr took me to the window of my room. The cool late afternoon summer breeze blew across me. She made me look out at the rolling grounds, the playing field, the little cemetery with Mr. Carey's cottage nearby, and beyond, the glint of water, a red boat on Long Island Sound, through the trees. "Don't you want that?" she said, standing behind me, squeezing her hands on my shoulders. "Don't you want to run through the grass and shout, or jump in the water and take it all in and blow it all out again like a whale?" I looked up at her silently, and she squeezed my shoulders harder.
Past the rusted gates and untrimmed hedges, Hill House broods and waits. In The Haunting of Hill House by Shirley Jackson, four seekers have come to the ugly, abandoned old mansion. Dr. Montague, an occult scholar looking for solid evidence of a haunting. Theodora, his lovely and lighthearted assistant. Eleanor, a lonely, homeless girl, a little too well acquainted with poltergeists. And Luke, the adventurous future heir of Hill House. At first, their stay seems destined to be merely an encounter with inexplicable noises and self-closing doors. But Hill House is gathering its powers and will soon choose one of them to make its own. To quote the New York Times book review, "makes your blood chill and your scalp prickle. Shirley Jackson is the master of the haunted tale." Well, Miss Jackson, we of the book report stand ready to be spooked. Bernadette Dunn narrates.
He had a list of perhaps a dozen names. Each of these people, then, received a letter from Dr. Montague extending an invitation to spend all or part of a summer at a comfortable country house, old but perfectly equipped with plumbing, electricity, central heating, and clean mattresses. The purpose of their stay, the letter stated clearly, was to observe and explore the various unsavory stories which had been circulated about the house for most of its 80 years of existence. Dr. Montague's letters did not say openly that Hill House was haunted, because Dr. Montague was a man of science, and until he had actually experienced a psychic manifestation in Hill House, he would not trust his luck too far. Consequently, his letters had a certain ambiguous dignity calculated to catch the imagination of a very special sort of reader. To his dozen letters, Dr. Montague had four replies, the other eight or so candidates having presumably moved and left no forwarding address, or possibly having lost interest in the supernormal, or even, perhaps, never having existed at all. To the four who replied, Dr. Montague wrote again, naming a specific day when the house would be officially regarded as ready for occupancy, and enclosing detailed directions for reaching it, since, as he was forced to explain, information about finding the house was extremely difficult to get, particularly from the rural community which surrounded it. On the day before he was to leave for Hill House, Dr. Montague was persuaded to take into his select company a representative of the family who owned the house, and a telegram arrived from one of his candidates, backing out with a clearly manufactured excuse. Another never came or wrote, perhaps because of some pressing personal problem which had intervened. The other two came. 2. Eleanor Vance was 32 years old when she came to Hill House. The only person in the world she genuinely hated, now that her mother was dead, was her sister. She disliked her brother-in-law and her 5-year-old niece, and she had no friends. This was owing largely to the 11 years she had spent caring for her invalid mother, which had left her with some proficiency as a nurse and an inability to face strong sunlight without blinking. She could not remember ever being truly happy in her adult life. Her years with her mother had been built up devotedly around small guilts and small reproaches, constant weariness, and unending despair. Without ever wanting to become reserved and shy, she had spent so long alone, with no one to love, that it was difficult for her to talk, even casually, to another person without self-consciousness and an awkward inability to find words. Her name had turned up on Dr. Montague's list because one day, when she was 12 years old and her sister was 18, and their father had been dead for not quite a month, showers of stones had fallen on their house. Without any warning or any indication of purpose or reason, dropping from the ceilings, rolling loudly down the walls, breaking windows, and pattering maddeningly on the roof. The stones continued intermittently for 3 days, during which time Eleanor and her sister were less unnerved by the stones than by the neighbors and sightseers who gathered daily outside the front door, and by their mother's blind hysterical insistence that all of this was due to malicious backbiting people on the block who had had it in for her ever since she came. After 3 days, Eleanor and her sister were removed to the house of a friend, and the stones stopped falling.
We've just heard The Haunting of Hill House by Shirley Jackson. On Halloween, could there be too many haunted house tales? The Book Report thinks not, so may I present The Woman in Black by Susan Hill. Eel Marsh House stands alone, atop windswept salt marshes beyond Nine Lives Causeway. Once, Mrs. Alice Drablow lived here as a recluse. Now, Arthur Kipps, a junior solicitor with a London firm, is summoned to attend her funeral and sort out her papers. Mr. Kipps is sadly unaware of the tragic and terrible secrets which lie behind the house's shuttered windows. At the funeral, Kipps glimpses a young woman clad all in black. A sense of profound unease begins to creep over him, a feeling deepened by the reluctance of the locals to talk about that woman, or what happens whenever she is seen. To accomplish his task, Kipps must stay on in the lonely house, sorting out Mrs. Drablow's papers. But then, The mist begins to enshroud both the house and its surrounding graveyard, and the high tide cuts it off from the world beyond. Be afraid, Kipps, be very afraid. Paul Ansdell narrates.
I had been both relieved and pleased when finally he took me into full partnership with himself after so many years, while at the same time believing the position to be no more than my due. For I had done my fair share of the donkey work, and borne a good deal of the burden of responsibility for directing the fortunes of the firm with, I felt, inadequate reward, at least in terms of position. So it came about that I was sitting beside Mr. Bentley on a Sunday afternoon, enjoying the view over the high hawthorn hedgerows across the green, drowsy countryside, as he let his pony take the road back, at a gentle pace, to his somewhat ugly and over-imposing manor house. It was rare for me to sit back and do nothing. In London, I lived for my work, apart from some spare time spent in the study and collecting of watercolours. I was then 35, and I had been a widower for the past 12 years. I had no taste at all for social life, and although in good general health, was prone to occasional nervous illnesses and conditions as a result of the experiences I will come to relate. Truth to tell, I was growing old well before my time, a sombre, pale-complexioned man with a strained expression, a dull dog. I remarked to Mr. Bentley on the calm and sweetness of the day, and after a sideways glance in my direction, he said, "You should think of getting yourself something in this direction. Why not? Pretty little cottage, down there, perhaps." And he pointed with his whip to where a tiny hamlet was tucked snugly into a bend of the river below, white walls basking in the afternoon sunshine. "Bring yourself out of town some of these Friday afternoons. Take to walking. Fill yourself up with fresh air and good eggs and cream." The idea had a charm, but only a distant one, seemingly unrelated to myself, so I merely smiled and breathed in the warm scents of the grasses and the field flowers, and watched the dust kicked up off the lane by the pony's hooves, and thought no more about it. Until, that is, we reached a stretch of road leading past a long, perfectly proportioned stone house, set on a rise above a sweeping view down over the whole river valley, and then for miles away to the violet-blue line of hills in the distance. At that moment, I was seized by something I cannot precisely describe. An emotion, a desire? No, it was rather more a knowledge, a simple certainty which gripped me, and all so clear and striking that I cried out involuntarily for Mr. Bentley to stop, and, almost before he had time to do so, climbed out of the pony trap into the lane and stood on a grassy knoll, gazing first up at the house, so handsome, so utterly right for the position it occupied. A modest house, and yet sure of itself. And then looking across at the country beyond. I had no sense of having been here before, but an absolute conviction that I would come here again, that the house was already mine, bound to me invisibly. To one side of it, a stream ran between the banks towards the meadow beyond, whence it made its meandering way down to the river. Mr. Bentley was now looking at me curiously from the trap. "A fine place," he called. I nodded, but quite unable to impart to him any of my extreme emotions, turned my back upon him and walked a few yards up the slope from where I could see the entrance to the old overgrown orchard that lay behind the house, and petered out in long grass and tangled thicket at the far end. Beyond that, I glimpsed the perimeter of some rough-looking, open land. The feeling of conviction I have described was still upon me, and I remember that I was alarmed by it, for I had never been an imaginative or fanciful man, and certainly not one given to visions of the future. Indeed, since those earlier experiences, I had deliberately avoided all contemplation of any remotely non-material matters, and clung to the prosaic, the visible, and tangible.
That was The Woman in Black by Susan Hill. Aaron Morgenstern's The Night Circus is perfect Halloween fare. I spoke to Aaron recently as her blockbuster novel was released in paperback for the first time. The consensus of many reviewers is, if you liked Harry Potter as a kid, you'll love The Night Circus as an adult. The Night Circus is her story of a life-or-death competition between two young magicians late in the 19th century. The contest takes place at the Circus of Dreams. Erin says she started with a circus and turned it into a story about choices and love, about finding the shades of gray between the black and the white. Erin is from Massachusetts and studied theater and studio art at Smith College. To quote Erin, her writing style is fantastical, fairy tale-esque things with magic, mystery, and tea, end quote. Welcome, Erin. Thanks so much for stopping by the Book Report.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
The Night Circus is incredibly popular, but there's been quite a story about the long road you had to take to getting it published, including more than a couple of setbacks from literary agents. Can you talk about that for a while?
Sure. I actually started the book about 5 years before it was actually finished, and I started doing National Novel Writing Month, which is an online-based challenge to write 50,000 words in 30 days. So that's sort of where I started writing seriously, and after a while, I had something that was sort of book-shaped, so I thought I'd look into publishing it and started learning about the publishing process and found a lot of things that said to never write in present tense and to never use second person, and I thought, oops, but I decided maybe I'd give it a whirl anyway, and I started querying literary agents, and I started getting requests, and I started getting rejections, and then I started getting a lot of rejections, and I think all told I probably got about 30-something rejections before I happened to be fortunate enough to stumble upon an agent who saw some potential in the manuscript, though he did want me to rewrite the entire thing. So when you have the stats that say it was rejected, like, however many times, it was really an earlier, much messier, perfectly rejectable draft that received all those rejections, because I did, after I started working with my agent, do a lot of revisions. So I actually revised it for almost a year after that initial sort of trying to send it out into the publishing world, before it was deemed finished enough to send to editors.
Describing the circus, one of your main characters describes it, quote, like no circus anyone has ever seen, not a single tent, but a multitude of tents, each with a particular exhibition, no elephants or clowns, an utterly unique experience, a feast for the senses, theatrics sans theater. How long did it take you to see the circus in your mind's eye before you put words to paper?
The circus appeared like in the middle of the writing process. Actually, I was working on a different story entirely, and I was bored with it. So out of desperation, I sent the characters to the circus, because in my head, just thinking right off the top of my head, I was like, what would be interesting? Circus. And as soon as I thought that, I had the space in my head. I didn't have all the nuances, but I had not one tent, but a lot of smaller tents. There was already a bonfire in the center courtyard, and this whole story developed taking that imaginary space that appeared instantly and really developing it and exploring it.
Well, I know that you're a very visual person. How has that influenced your writing?
I think it has a huge influence on my writing, because I see everything in my head. I don't hear the words, I see the images. I'll hear the dialogue sometimes, but as far as the visuals and the spaces and the action of any given scene, I'm seeing it all in my head. It's very movie-like in my imagination. So most of my writing process is translating those pictures and those images into the proper words to describe them, so maybe the reader can get a similar sort of picture in their own head.
You know, in reading the book, with a topic as colorful as the circus, there is so much that you've written as black and white. Why?
I love black and white. I've always loved it as a color scheme in general. I think there's something very interesting about it visually, like even going into like old black and white films. I think since everything gets distilled to light and shadow, it creates a very interesting visual image to me. It's almost, you can almost see the image clearer by removing the color information. And then, of course, I love to throw a little bit of red on top of the black and white.
Yes.
Because it makes the red seem almost redder.
I know the circus groupies wore black and white with just a flash of scarlet. I love that.
Yes, I wanted the circus has a sort of fandom, and I love the idea of fandom in general, that sort of shared love of something, bringing people together. So I wanted the circus fan community to be a very particular thing, and one of the ways I did that was I kind of gave them a uniform.
Yeah. Well, time and clocks play such a big role in the book. Why is that imagery so central?
I started playing with time almost immediately. Originally, the story was much less linear. It already isn't quite linear. It has two overlapping timelines. But I wanted it to be told from a lot of different perspectives. And I think one of the wonderful things about getting to write a book is you don't have to be stuck to an order in time. You can kind of go anywhere you want in the narrative. And so time became a sort of instant theme. And then I have a character as a clockmaker. And that actually tied in partially out of just serendipitously because I picked clockmaking as an occupation for him when he appeared in my head because I wanted him to do something that seemed like magic but wasn't.
Yes.
So that's where I came up with making these amazing clocks.
Okay, I want you to talk a little bit about Chandrasekhar, who was the circus creator, and you feel very strongly throughout the book is kind of moving people and places. Talk about him.
Chandra is one of my favorite characters who hardly ever gets mentioned, so thank you for bringing him up. He is the circus proprietor. He's a theatrical producer and kind of always looking to push boundaries and comes up with this amazing theatrical experience. And he's actually based a little bit, his storyline is based a little bit about my own experience as a theater director when I was studying theater in college, because it's a weird position to be in, to be controlling everything, but really having very little to do with the day-to-day operation of something. You're such an intrinsic part of it, but you're not at the same time. So that's where part of his story, and he was an interesting character to write because of that. It's a strange place to find yourself in, and then of course there's all sorts of magical shenanigans going on that he's not even fully aware of to make it even more complicated.
Now the book is being turned into a movie. What's that like for you?
It's weird, and I'm trying not to think too much about it because it's very strange to think that it's a possibility, but they are working on it. Summit Entertainment, who did the Twilight movies, has the film option, and they've hired David Heyman, who produced the Harry Potter movies, and the screenplay is being written as we speak. So that's where things are going. And of course, the process of turning something like this into a film is a long and involved one, but the goal is to eventually have there be a movie, so we shall see.
Oh, it would be such a wonderful movie. Now, were you involved with getting Jim Dale of Harry Potter fame to narrate the audiobook?
No, I had nothing to do with this, and it was apparently my literary agent's idea. But give it to Jim Dale, and luckily for us, Jim wanted to do it, and he has the most wonderful storyteller voice. So I was absolutely thrilled to have him do the audio. I was luckily enough to see a little bit of the actual recording, which was fascinating. So I got to sit in the studio and watch him read through. And at one point he stopped and complained to me that why did I have to name her Tsukiko? Because it's hard to say. And he had to say it quite a bit.
Yeah. Okay, and what book are you working on next?
I am working on something that's probably best described as a film noir flavored Alice in Wonderland.
Oh.
It is not nearly book-shaped yet, but it still has a fantastical quality like the circus, but it's a very different flavor.
Well, Erin, your book is really magical to read. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you very much.
All righty, bye.
Yes, readers, Halloween is time for quirky. And the Book Report serves it up with style in Stephen Sherrill's The Minotaur Takes a Cigarette Break. 5,000 years out of the labyrinth, the Minotaur finds himself in the American South, living in a trailer park and working as a line cook at a steakhouse.
No longer a devourer of human flesh, the Minotaur is socially inept, lonely, and with very human needs. But over a two-week period, as his life dissolves into chaos, the broken and alienated immortal awakens to the possibility for happiness and for the capacity to love. Holter Graham narrates.
The Minotaur sits on an empty pickle bucket, blowing smoke through bullish nostrils. He sits near the dumpster on the dock of the kitchen at Grubb's Rib, smoking, and watching Jojo the dishwasher dance on the thin strip of crumbling asphalt that begins three steps down at the base of the dock, runs the length of the building's backside, and stops abruptly at the overgrown bank, thick with jimson weed, honeysuckle, and scraggly pine, leading down to the interstate. It's hot, and through the haze and the treetops, the Minotaur can just make out a piece of the billboard advertising the restaurant. Next exit. The Minotaur doesn't like to smoke, but smokes anyway. Smokes menthols because he likes them even less. While Jojo dances to the staticky music thumping out of the boombox at his feet, the music fighting with the sounds of the exhaust fan over their heads and the incessant traffic on the highway below. It's hot, as hot outside as in the kitchen. Jojo's black face and arms jut from the stained white uniform, jerking and twisting in furious rhythms. His chocolate skin has a sheen of sweat. The steps, the loading dock, the dumpster gaping open like a dumb metal mouth, the pavement itself, even the weeds and bushes, have a permanent layer of grease, of animal fat spilled or blown through the exhaust year after year. Everything stinks. Everything is slick and hard to hold. But it's like the heat. People get used to it. Order up! The Minotaur hears from the tinny little speaker hanging just inside the kitchen door. It's Adrian. She's the only one who whines like that. The Minotaur picks at a dried gravy stain on his apron, thinks for a minute about Adrian. He thinks. He thinks it because everyone else says it. Big, bouncing inside the ruffled tuxedo shirt that is her uniform, and a big nose, both of which stir his soup. But these kinds of thoughts never lead anywhere and are ultimately painful to him, so he doesn't linger on them. Besides, she always seems mad at him. The Minotaur is a line cook. He works the dinner shift, in at 3 and out at midnight after cleanup, later on the weekends. He works the hotline, the steam table, the fry daddy, and the convection ovens. Most of the appetizers and a few of the entrees come from his station. When it's slow, he helps with salads and desserts as well. On busy nights, there are two others on the line, Cece on salads, and a lean, quiet man named Hernando, who works the sauté station and cuts the prime rib on Friday and Saturday nights.
We've just heard a sampling of The Minotaur Takes a Cigarette Break by Stephen Sherrill. Don't touch that dial. The book report will be right back.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Mayu is an assuming young businessman living in London with a dull job and a pretty but shrewish fiancée. Then one night, he stumbles upon a girl lying on the sidewalk bleeding. He stops to help her, and his life is changed forever. In Neverwhere, written and narrated by Neil Gaiman, our hero Richard finds himself living in a London most people have never dreamed of. A city of monsters and saints, murderers and angels. It is a world that exists entirely in a subterranean labyrinth of sewer canals and abandoned subway stations. And it is the home of Dor, the girl Richard rescued, and the person who must now preserve the strange underworld kingdom from destruction.
I was married in London, but he was a bad lot. Me mam told me not to go marrying outside, but I was young and beautiful, although you'd never credit it today, and I followed my heart. I'm sure you did, said Richard, embarrassed. The conviction that he was about to be sick was starting, slowly, to fade. Fat lot of good it done me. I've been homeless, so I know what it's like, said the old woman. That's why I thought you was. What you going to London for? I've got a job, he told her proudly. Doing what? She asked. Securities, said Richard. I was a dancer, said the old woman, and she tottered awkwardly around the sidewalk, humming tunelessly to herself. Then she teetered from side to side like a spinning top coming to rest, and finally she stopped, facing Richard. Hold out your hand, she told him, and I'll tell your fortune. He did as he was told. She put her old hand into his and held it tightly, and then she blinked a few times, like an owl who had swallowed a mouse that was beginning to disagree with it. You got a long way to go, she said, puzzled. London, Richard told her. Not just London. The old woman paused. Not any London I know. It started to rain then, softly. I'm sorry, she said. It starts with doors. Doors? She nodded. The rain fell harder, pattering on the roofs and on the asphalt of the road. I'd watch out for doors if I were you. Richard stood up a little unsteadily. All right, he said, a little unsure of how one ought to treat information of this nature. I will. Thanks. The pub door was opened, and light and noise spilled out into the street. Richard, you all right? Yeah, I'm fine. I'll be back in a second. The old lady was already wobbling down the street into the pelting rain, getting wet. Richard felt he had to do something for her. He couldn't give her money, though. He hurried after her, down the narrow street, the cold rain drenching his face and hair. Here, said Richard. He fumbled with the handle of the umbrella, trying to find the button that opened it. Then a click, and it blossomed into a huge white map of the London Underground network, each line drawn in a different colour, every station marked and named. The old woman took the umbrella, gratefully, and smiled her thanks. You've a good heart, she told him. Sometimes that's enough to see you safe wherever you go. Then she shook her head. But mostly it's not. She clutched the umbrella tightly, as a gust of wind threatened to tug it away from her or pull it inside out. She wrapped her arms around it and bent almost double against the rain and the wind. Then she walked away into the rain and the night, a round white shape covered with the names of London tube stations, Earl's Court, Marble Arch, Blackfriars, White City, Victoria, Angel, Oxford Circus. Richard found himself pondering, drunkenly, whether there really was a circus at Oxford Circus, a real circus with clowns and beautiful women and dangerous beasts. The pub door opened once more, a blast of sound as if the pub's volume control had just been turned up high. Richard, you wanker, it's your bloody party and you're missing all the fun. He walked back in the pub, the urge to be sick lost in all the oddness. You look like a drowned rat, said someone. You've never seen a drowned rat, said Richard. Someone else handed him a large whiskey. Here, get that down you. That'll warm you up. You know, you won't be able to get real scotch in London.
That Was Neverwhere by Neil Gaiman. Halloween Party by Agatha Christie calls up the one and only Hercule Poirot to take on ghosts, goblins, and murderers. Famous crime novelist Ariadne Oliver is invited to a friend's Halloween party for the local teenagers in the small hamlet of Woodley Common. During party preparations, the conversation turns to Ariadne's grisly novels. One of the teenagers, Joyce Reynolds, boasts she once witnessed a murder, though at the time she hadn't realized what she'd seen. Convinced she's just trying to attract attention, no one believes her. But soon after, she's found tragically drowned in an apple-bobbing tub. Ariadne calls upon her old friend Poirot to solve the case. Poirot knows he must discover if the teenager was telling the truth about the murder she witnessed. If so, he must investigate not one murder, but two. John Moffat stars as the great Belgian detective in this BBC Radio 4 full-cast dramatization.
Halloween party? I thought that sort of thing only happened in America.
Goodness, no. You lead such a sheltered life, Ariadne. Haven't you seen all the witches' hats in the shops? Anyway, I promised Rowena Drake that I'd lend a hand, and I did kind of hint that you might be going.
I hope you didn't make any rash promises on my behalf, Judith. I don't want to find myself presenting the prize for the best pumpkin.
I didn't promise anything. Well, she knows your books, of course.
So many people do.
I thought it might provide you with a story.
Mummy, I'm sure my temperature's gone down. There's nothing wrong with me at all. I'm sure she'll be fine by this evening. Can't I go?
Half an hour ago, it was 102. You can't have recovered just like that. Back to bed, Miranda.
But everyone else will be going.
Well, they'll just have to do without you. Off you go. Mrs. Holt will bring you a cup of tea. Come on, Ariadne. I promised Mrs. Drake we'd be there by 3.
And I'm not expected to do anything.
Nothing at all. Just think of it as the background for one of your murder stories.
I'm so glad you were able to come, Mrs. Oliver. And it was so good of you to agree to judge the girls' fancy dress competition. They'll be so thrilled.
Fancy dress? But I understood that I wasn't going
Where
to be asked...
Where are you going to have the snapdragon, Mrs. Drake?
In the dining room.
I'd best get something to cover up the table, then.
There's a green beige cloth in the cupboard in the kitchen.
I thought we'd hang those fairy lights all the way around the landing, Mrs. Drake. Will that be all right?
You're not going to hammer any nails in.
Oh, no, we'll just tie them up.
Is there anything I can do to help?
Gracious no, Mrs. Oliver. Why don't you find
Where's
a chair?
Where's the lobbing for apples going to be?
In the library. Mrs. Minden's gone off to find a really solid bucket, one that won't fall over. This is Ariadne Oliver, Miss Whittaker.
How do you do?
Miss Whittaker teaches at the Elms. That's the school most of the girls go to.
How do you do? You know, I've never understood what apple bobbing had to do with Halloween. It doesn't seem appropriate somehow.
Apples were supposed to be associated with happy souls. You were given an apple to keep the evil spirits away.
Evil spirits?
Halloween was the night when the force of evil was at its most powerful, when witches were free to consort with the devil. And in this part of the world, they used to hold a Sabbath at the old stone circle at Kilterbury. Kilterbury Ring.
For on Allah's Eve, the night I shall ride, and all our ninefold sweeping on by our side.
Are you going to tell the girls' fortunes this year, Mrs. Goodbody?
Well, I don't do the telling exactly. I give them a mirror, and they see the face of the man they're going to marry.
Oh, that's what that ingenious contraption is that Nick is rigging up. It's to project pictures onto the mirrors.
Are you the lady that writes the detective books?
Yes, that's right.
I read one of them once, The Dying Goldfish. I thought it was quite good.
Thank you, dear.
I thought it was a bit tame, really. Only one murder.
One murder is generally quite enough for most people.
We've just heard Halloween Party by Agatha Christie. Readers, I'm hoping your Halloween is filled with fun. To supplement the festivities, don't forget to indulge in a great horror story. It's much more satisfying than a Snickers bar and won't cause blood-curdling shrieks when next you face that frightening monster, the bathroom scale. See you next week on The Book Report.